When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to All Rings Considered, Entertainment Weekly's podcast breaking down The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. We are a little over halfway through season one, and we are gathered here around a very fancy and very special stone table to talk about episode five, titled Partings. We are joined today by the High King of the Elves himself, Gil-galad, aka Benjamin Walker, who we're very excited to have back. He'll be joining us later to break down this episode in a bit, but first, I'm your host, Devin Cogan, and I am joined as always by my favorite traveling companion, Christian Holub. Christian, how's it going?
Good, Devin. It's a beautiful fall day here in New York City today. The weather is nice and crisp. I don't drink coffee, but people who are, I'm sure, are ordering their pumpkin spice lattes. I'm listening to Nico Case and thinking about when I'm going to rewatch Over the Garden Wall.
Yes.
Fall is a very Tolkien-y season, I feel like. So definitely in the mood to talk about the latest episode of Rings of Power.
Yeah, well, let's start with a very autumnal vibe. We're going to head to Linden, which is very, very, it's got a very kind of cozy fall vibe. Lots of yellow leaves and
perhaps a little too autumnal as far as the king is concerned.
I was going to say, I mean, this is definitely not the spring of the Kingdom of the Elves. You know, there's a lot to unpack this episode, a lot going on all across Middle Earth. But we're going to start in Linden because there's some interesting things happening. In this episode, we learn a little bit more about kind of what the elves are up to and kind of what's going on in Gil-galad's head. He's a very stoic king. He doesn't tell everyone everything. And we learn a little bit about kind of his motivations here. We learn that he and Celebrimbor have sort of sent Elrond on a little bit of an errand without telling him what's going on. We learn that they are searching for an ore that we know now as Mithril. And he and Celebrimbor believe that it will help stave off decay and preserve the power of the elves, which is a really interesting kind of twist and not something I was really expecting. Christian, what did you make of this whole, you know, kind of reveal about what's going on with the elves and the dwarves?
Yeah, well, you know, it's definitely very strange to kind of hear some Silmarillion karaoke to go along with all the actual Silmarillion references we've had. You know, the story that Gil-galad tells Elrond in this episode about the origins of Mithril, as he and Celebrimbor understand it, their theory is that there was a battle over one of the three Silmarils between a nameless elf warrior and a big old Balrog, and that battle caused the light of the Silmaril to seep into the earth and create this vein of Mithril that's in Khazad Dûm. And Gil-galad thinks that that is the key to preserving elf longevity and dominion, you know. And what's weird about this story is that it sounds similar to things that are in the Silmarillion, but it's not in the Silmarillion. And one of the ways you know is that the elf warrior has no name, because everybody has a freaking name in Tolkien and in the Silmarillion.
Usually they have like nine names. Yeah.
Right. And there's also a funny thing of there's only one Balrog, and usually in the Silmarillion, if there's a Balrog involved, there's like five of them. So that was making me like turn my head a little bit. But, you know, it's presented as apocryphal. It's presented as a little vague. And so it might be the kind of thing, and I'll be interested, and listeners will surely be interested when we catch up with Benjamin Walker later, about maybe Gil-galad is playing some kind of game here. I don't know if he's made this up whole cloth, but it may not be totally true. In any case, I was just left with a little feeling of strangeness. Although it is interesting that, you know, we knew that Celebrimbor was working on some kind of project. Your assumption and mine is that that project is in the title, which it will probably eventually be, but this is kind of their first attempt at finding some magical way for elves to maintain their kingdoms, even though, you know, change and the death and decay that change involves is a natural part of life. Elves, you know, even though they don't have the gift of Iluvatar of death, they have to find some way of countering that, or they think they do. You know, that's what's kind of interesting about this. It's like, we're not given a ton of direct evidence for any of this. It's all kind of just like word of mouth. And, you know, if we empathize with Galadriel, which I think a lot of us do, then we already have reasons to distrust Gil-galad and his decision-making process. So it's all kind of interesting. You know, what did you think of all that?
Yeah, I felt kind of similarly to you, where I was really intrigued by this. It was something where I was like, oh, I was surprised by this. That, you know, mm-hmm. there haven't been a ton of surprises in this show so far, you know, because a lot of these characters we know, a lot of the main bullet points we know. But this was sort of an interesting reveal to me. And it's not an unfamiliar concept. You know, all throughout Lord of the Rings, you know, they talk constantly about how specifically Galadriel and Elrond use the Elvish Rings of Power to protect their kingdom and to stave off decay and sort of maintain the power and the longevity of the elves. It's kind of a nebulous concept where it's like, okay, the elves are decaying or diminishing. And it's something that's sort of talked about a lot, but the idea is that the rings are used to sort of maintain that power. So the idea that the elves are you know, diminishing and Gil-galad is desperately searching for a way to help preserve that is very true to Tolkien. But some of the details of, you know, the story about the origin of Mithril is interesting. And I do like that it is presented as sort of, you know, Elrond is the one who says, you know, it's apocryphal. It's I don't believe it's a true story. It's a legend. But I do believe that, you know, if Gil-galad is so desperate to maintain the power of the elves, that he would go to extreme lengths and maybe cling to these ideas of this legend he heard once about, you know, the power of a Silmaril seeping into the earth and creating Mithril. So I found it really interesting. But I was particularly interested less in sort of the details of that and more about Elrond and sort of him grappling with the burden of this oath that he swore to his friend Durin in the last episode. And does he break that? Does he value his oath with his friend over his loyalty to his king and his loyalty to all of his people? There was a really lovely moment where, you know, Gil-galad sort of presents him with this choice and he says, I cannot break my oath to my friend. I that's kind of all I have. And he's, as Gil-galad walks away, Elrond is looking up at the stars, which I thought was really beautiful because he's looking for his dad.
He's looking for his dad.
To his father for guidance. And then it immediately cuts to one of the great statues in Numenor, where we see Arendil with the Silmaril on his brow. It's a statue of him. So I thought that was a really, I'm less interested in some of the, like the lore and the details there, you know, about like, okay, is this a true story or not about the origin of Mithril? And as opposed to that emotional connection between Elrond and Durin, and does he betray his friend or, you know, betray his people? So I thought that was a really, I was very moved by that, even if some of like the details of the plot, I was a little, you know, like, oh, I've never heard that before. That's an interesting idea. But to me, focusing it on that relationship, I thought was really, really beautiful.
Yeah. And that's something that the show is kind of poised to give us. You know, we don't really get into Elrond's head a lot in Lord of the Rings or Silmarillion or think about his emotional relationships to his dad and his brother. You know, you can read his affection for his brother Elros into the ways he cares for Aragorn and all of that. But it's cool to kind of see that a little viscerally. I also think what's interesting about this whole storyline is how it reflects the relationship between dwarves and elves.
Yes.
Durin is quickly becoming my favorite character.
Me too.
I love the performance. I love the character. He makes me laugh and smile all the time, especially at the end of this episode when he, as you said, Elrond was defending his friendship and his oath to his friend against his king. And Durin basically kind of promised to do the same. So that friendship is really lovely to see and obviously has been since they first appeared together in the second episode. Obviously, this isn't the first elf-dwarf friendship we've seen on screen, but what's interesting about this is it's kind of like, you know, Legolas and Gimli were also like together for months and months and months just with each other, with Aragorn and the Fellowship. Like, they weren't constantly having to report back to their dads or their rulers who had other agendas. So you see kind of how this, you know, because it would be so easy to think, you know, watch Lord of the Rings and see how Gimli and Legolas get along, or watch this show and see how Durin and Elrond get along and be like, so what's the big deal with dwarves and elves? you know, this is kind of how that happened. It's not so much like an individual thing as it is like, you know, two nations and two polities and stuff that have different kind of conflicting agendas. You know, whenever they're together, they get along. It's whenever they have to go back and report to King Durin or Gil-galad that they're like, no, you shouldn't do that. You should lie to him. You should do this, that, or the other thing. So, you know, it's hard to imagine that this storyline doesn't end tragically in multiple ways, because we know the state of dwarf elf enmity at the beginning of Lord of the Rings. And as we've alluded to on previous episodes, you know, digging for Mithril will eventually lead to, speaking of, which is another part of that story, is it's a little bit of foreshadowing too, because digging for Mithril will lead to the Balrog that will destroy everything we love about the Kingdom of Khazad-dûm. That might be coming in season 5, but you know, we know that that's an end point. So, you know, it's cool. And, you know, our listeners, maybe they've only watched the movies or only read Lord of the Rings itself, but even people who have read The Silmarillion or maybe haven't read it in a while, maybe it's worth kind of rehashing a little bit the history of the dwarf-elf relationship, not least because Durin, every time he stubs his toe or gets mad or whatever, invokes Aule, who is one of the Valar and actually the creator of the dwarves, because the dwarves were created in a very different way to elves and men, who were both created by Iluvatar. Dwarves were not. And there's certain kind of opposition built into them from the get-go because of their different origins. But then there are also a couple specific things that happen in the Silmarillion that make that relationship even more kind of visceral and angry. And it seems like this show is poised to maybe show us some more, you know, kind of flashpoints in this long, tumultuous relationship. But Devin, did you want to begin a little history lesson for our viewers?
I mean, I'll let you take that one. But there, yeah, I love sort of how I've been really delighted by how the show has sort of like taken some of these like little references and little nods throughout. Like in one of the very first episodes when Elrond first travels to Khazad-dûm and we hear Disa say, like you said, as a swear, it's Aule's beard, as opposed to in The Lord of the Rings, it's always Durin's beard, which is, I thought, was a fun little weird detail that of course, you know, thousands of years ago, they would have a different, you know, reference point there.
Right. And shows that kind of the familiarity and relationship to the Valar will kind of only decrease over time.
Exactly. Because it's so much newer in, I mean, it's only been a couple thousand years at this point, and it'll be several thousand more by the time the Third Age rolls around. But yeah, kind of walk us through a little bit. As you mentioned, you know, there is this difference in their creation, you know, dating back to when the elves awoke under the stars, and then the dwarves were essentially created in secret by by Aule. They were sort of crafted from, brought to life out of stone. Walk us through sort of how that sort of sets up that, like you said, that clash between the elves and the dwarves.
Right. The elves and men are the creations of Iluvatar. The elves are the firstborn. They live forever unless they get killed, and men are the secondborn race, and they get the gift of Iluvatar, which is death and mortality, which means that their lives mean something when they're on Earth, Middle Earth, because they only have a limited time. And then, you know, Tolkien was a Catholic, so then it also involves that they get to go somewhere beyond, whereas elves will die with the world. And dwarves were not created by Iluvatar. They were created by one of the Valar, which is the pantheon. They're not really gods because Iluvatar is the god, but they function like a pantheon from mythology. They kind of familiar, all the familiar archetypes, like Manwë, who's the leader, and who they, I believe Gil-galad name checks him in that story. He says the elf that fought the Balrog was as noble as Manwë.
Yeah, I think he says he has the strength of Manwë or something along those lines.
He has the strength of Manwë, yeah. Because Manwë is like Zeus. He's the god of the, he's the sky father, and the god of, the eagles are Manwë's best buds. He lives at the top of Olympus, all this kind of stuff. There's Varda is his queen.
Yep. Called Elbereth by the elves.
Yeah, and then I saw some eagle-eyed people online, fans pointing out online that there's maybe a little coded reference to Varda in the background of a previous episode where one of her constellations, which is a sickle, because Varda's amazing. She's kind of like, you know, she's analogous to Hera or Athena, I guess, as kind of the foremost female goddess. But she's also, like Athena or whatever, she's also kind of a goddess of war.
Well, she's supposedly the only one who really scared
Who scares Morgoth.
Yeah.
And so she put this constellation in the sky like a sickle as a memo to him that I'm going to get you someday. And she eventually did.
We love that.
And she's kind of the goddess of stars. Yeah, she's amazing. I'm not going to go through all the Valar. I just wanted to bring that those were the two. Those were the two main ones. And then Ale is like Hephaestus or something. He's the smith god. He's the god of craftsmen. And so he's doing all this stuff. He's building all these things in the early days of the world. But he's a smith. And, you know, any kind of scientist or craftsman or whatever, they always want to push their art as far as they can. And so he eventually takes, well, why don't I try to create life, my own beings? And so he creates these beings kind of out of stone and minerals and stuff. But he doesn't have the power of life. So he can't bring them to life. He can only kind of mold their form. And Iluvatar finds out. And instead of being mad, like, he kind of understands where Ale is coming from. And he acquiesces to it in that he gives life to the dwarves. So that's where the dwarves come from. They just have this different, like, at their very root, they're different from the elves. They're not as blessed. They're not as chosen. You know, you can see some of that still in Durin's kind of instinctual resentment of Elrond and the elves as kind of these highborn, you know, privileged class of beings who don't really care for people, beings that they see as less special than them. And the only reason I wanted to get into the Valar as much as I did is because there's a subsidiary class of being called the Maiar, who are more like angels. And the Maiar, kind of each Maiar is in the entourage of a Valar. There's one that they learn from. And the reason I mention that is because one of Ale's Maiar, one of the Maiar that originally followed Ale, was Sauron, which is why Sauron is so good at making things and building things, which we will, of course, see over the course of the show before he joined the rebellion, you know, joined Lucifer's rebellion and joined Morgoth. So that's kind of the deep-rooted thing. And then there are, you know, some things that happen in the Silmarillion. If I'm remembering correctly, a big one is the Elf King Thingol at one point had this amazing necklace that was like the masterpiece of the dwarves of that time, because the dwarves follow Ale. They are created by the god of craftsmen. And so they take a lot of pride in being craftsmen themselves. And they create all this beautiful jewelry and weapons and stuff. The Nargolamir, I might be mispronouncing that, was this necklace that they had given to the Elf King. And then he held it too long. And eventually a bunch of dwarves like to kill him and steal it back. So that's bad. And elves have long memories. I mean, Galadriel remembers Valinor, you know, like, yeah. It's hard to, you know, it's one thing maybe with Rohan and Gondor to kind of overcome their differences in Lord of the Rings, because, you know, generations have passed, older kings have died and stuff. That doesn't really happen with the elves. So when you do something bad to them, even though those dwarves are long dead, the elves remember. So
they hold a grudge.
Those are the highlights kind of the history of the dwarf-elf rivalry for anybody who's curious. And I really am enjoying the way that the show is portraying it and portraying the way that, you know, maybe as individuals you can connect one way, but that's not necessarily how different peoples connect, and things pop up and people have different motivations. So I'm really excited to see where this storyline keeps going.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit at the top of the show, but the table is so good. It's such a good, like, indication of that whole relationship, where you can tell that, you know, Durin is trying to, you know, kind of play on the fact that Gil-galad doesn't know a lot about dwarves, and he's trying to be a good politician and being like, you know, and pick his battles very much so. And Durin just totally takes advantage of that. And the little detail at the end where Elrond's like, "You made all that up, didn't you?" And he's like, "Yeah, decent one has been wanting a new table." So I cannot wait to see how great that table looks in Khazad-dûm.
In Deeza's living room, yeah.
Exactly.
She's got a great plan for it.
That was something I was delighted by. Well, we talked a little bit about, there's that great scene where we see Elrond looking up at the stars, and then it cuts to the statue of his dad in Numenor.
So let's cut to Numenor.
Cut to Numenor. Let's set sail for Numenor, where a lot of things are happening. The last episode was a very Numenor-heavy episode, which ended with Muriel vowing to go to war and amass an army and head to the Southlands, as asked by Galadriel. And here we see sort of the preparations for that. It's sort of the calm before the storm as everybody is preparing to set sail. We see great armies being amassed. We see sailors preparing. There's a great shot of somebody lifting a horse via crane onto a ship. This poor horse is like dangling in the air. I love this horse. I want to know everything about this horse. But and we hear a little bit about, you know, there's a lot of different pieces here. We got to talk about a scene that should come as no surprise to you that I absolutely loved, because Christian knows that I love ladies with swords. And so I absolutely loved the scene where Galadriel just totally schools all of these Numenorean recruits on how to train and use a sword. And sure, it was a little self-indulgent, a little ridiculous, but I loved every single minute of it. The score was so much fun. I loved the smile on Morfydd Clark's face as she's leaping around with the sword. It shows the agility and the skill of the elves in such a beautiful way. And I absolutely loved the scene. I like immediately rewound it and was like, I can't wait to pull that up on YouTube just all the time and just like rewatch Galadriel just having the fun of just jumping around with a sword. Like, man, I want a sword. I don't know what to do with a sword, but I want a sword.
Do you not have one? I thought you got one recently.
I do have a replica of Sting.
Okay. So, well, I guess it's up for debate whether Sting is a sword or not.
It's more of a dagger. It's kind of a short sword.
Yeah, it's a sword for a hobbit. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I loved that scene too. It's great to see Galadriel having some fun. She hasn't had a ton of opportunity for that so far in the show. You know, and you know what it reminded me of? A scene from another show we love, Avatar: The Last Airbender, in the third season when Aang is pretending to be a Fire Nation kid and is kind of in the similar situation where he's in kind of this yard with these firebending boys and provokes them or whatever. So they're fighting him and he does kind of that Galadriel thing where he's a pacifist and an airbender and all that. We're not going to get into that, but he does the same thing where he just like, he schools all these people, not even by, sometimes the best way to own someone in a fight is to just like easily dodge all their blows, you know? So I enjoyed that and it gave me some Aang vibes from Galadriel there.
It's a little Luke Skywalker Last Jedi where he faces off against Kylo Ren.
Yes. Another good comparison.
We love a sword fight where swords that don't actually touch.
You don't actually touch. Or lightsabers. Yeah. As discussed on Dagobah Dispatch recently. Yeah.
Exactly. If you were a Star Wars fan, you can hear us yell about Star Wars too. if you didn't hear enough of us being total geeks about Middle Earth. But I was really fascinated by all the stuff in Numenor. One of the things I really wanted to point out and mention was some of the stuff with Isildur and Elendil, where specifically he got kicked out of the Sea Guard, but now he's like, oh, this is my chance. I'm going to go to war. I'm going to find my purpose and become a war hero.
Speaking of Luke Skywalker.
Major Luke Skywalker vibes. And he goes to his dad and is like, Dad, can you cut me to the front of the line and like so I can get on your ship? And his dad is like so disappointed. And poor Elendil's like, he kind of dresses him down a little bit, which I kind of love. Like, we love a disappointed dad speech.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like a nice moment where you could see like Isildur kind of like reckon with the weight of sort of the path that's ahead of him and what he has to do if he wants to become a person of note. And there was that line that sort of sent up little flares for me, which is where Elendil says something along the lines of, I hope that you find something that you're willing to risk anything for. And that sort of was a little bit of a gut punch if you know where Isildur's story goes. And, you know, he does find something that he is willing to risk everything for. And it may prove to not be such a good thing.
Yeah. Wonder if his dad's words are ringing in his ears when he refuses to throw a certain object into a certain place.
But for sure.
I liked... you know, one thing that was interesting about that, it kind of draws an interesting comparison between Elendil and Farazan, doesn't it? Where Elendil is like, no, you don't get special privileges just for being my son. You have to earn it just like everybody else does. And then we see Farazan and his son. And of course, Farazan's son has been presumably spoiled his whole life. And as a result, thinks that he has more power and influence than he does and thinks that he can just walk up to his dad, not the regent, but, you know, the prime minister equivalent, basically, of Numenor, and tell him what to do. And Farazan dresses down his son in a way and is like, oh, you don't know anything and you don't see the board at all and you don't see how these moves are advantaging me, which makes sense because he has a little bit of a crush and that's clearly what his motivations are coming from. So I thought that was an interesting comparison. You know, we saw Farazan speaking in the streets, demagoguish and kind of getting a crowd going. And now we hear from his son that, you know, Muriel may hold the scepter, but it's you the people follow. I thought that was also a good establishment, if it hasn't been made clear already, that he and Muriel are cousins and are both part of the Farazan. He's not just like her advisor. He's also part of the royal family.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an important comparison. And yeah, you know, I was a little disappointed that last episode ended with, all right, Numenor's going to Middle Earth. And this episode also ends with, all right, Numenor's going to Middle Earth. But that did give us some needed momentum at the end of last week. And the extra moments we got on Numenor before the departure I think are helping to establish the characters and their relationships and how they're similar and different from each other. But you know, Devin, you liked Galadriel's fun moment that she got to have this episode in the fighting yard. What did you think of her intense moment and her conversation with Hallbrand, where she kind of bared her soul to someone, which we haven't really seen in the show so far?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating moment. And I've really been fascinated by the Hallbrand-Galadriel relationship throughout the show.
Yeah.
They're very antagonistic towards each other, but they also see the great potential in each other. And they also are sort of able to call each other out because they're both clearly running from something. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy for them to recognize it in each other. And so it sort of culminates with that big conversation between the two of them, where she basically calls him out on running from his heritage and his destiny and his duty to protect the Southlands and to protect his people and take up his mantle. And he calls her out on sort of her constant quest for vengeance and her inability to leave anything alone and mm-hmm. her obsessive desire for war, essentially, and for conflict. And she has that moment where he asks her why, and she says, because I can't stop. And she doesn't know what, she's been doing this for so long that she doesn't know who she is without her oath that she basically swore in her brother's place. And so it's interesting. We've heard a lot about oaths in this show. You know, oaths play a big role. Here we see Galadriel, you know, talking about her oath to her brother. We obviously hear Elrond, you know, fretting over what to do about his oath to Durin about Mithril. And oaths play a big role in Tolkien's work. You know, we see that across his work. I mean, obviously the Oathbreakers and the King Under the Mountain is a huge plot line where Aragorn calls on this king to fulfill his broken promise. We hear it in Frodo speaking to Gollum. He makes Gollum basically swear to protect him and to not betray him.
From Sam, the end of Fellowship. I made a promise, Mr. Frodo, a promise.
Exactly. And so promises play a very big role. And so I'm fascinated by kind of Galadriel's journey and the idea of who is she without that promise? When can that promise ever be fulfilled? And who will she be if and when it is? So I was very fascinated by that. I also love the bit of Halbrand kind of finally accepting his heritage and his fate. And he shows up having taken a shower and having washed his hair for the first time and looking kind of kingly. And all the Numenoreans are like, whoa, who's this dude? I thought this was just like some castaway with greasy, stringy hair. Now he looks like a real person. It's like when Aragorn shows up and everybody's like, oh, wow, he took a shower. Maybe he really is the King of Gondor.
But, and in both cases, it's kind of intentional. Like maybe if I'm just really dirty, they won't think that I'm a king or whatever.
Exactly. Well, not all that glitters is gold.
That's right.
You know, we will get into that a little bit more later. But I love that whole bit.
Yeah, I just wanted to add what you were saying about oaths being important to Tolkien and Lord of the Rings. There are a lot of great positive examples of sticking to your oaths and fulfilling them. Obviously, the oath that the Fellowship makes to each other that, you know, allows Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli to go save Merry and Pippin. Like I said last week, I've been rereading Two Towers, so that stuff is really fresh in my mind. But the other thing, which again, it's hard, you know, like I said, that story in this episode about Mithril is Silmarillion-y, but not actually in the Silmarillion. Something that is in the Silmarillion and runs throughout is this really kind of incredible opposite story of how sticking to an oath and fulfilling an oath can cause untold destruction and horror. And this is maybe the last Silmarillion reference I'll make this episode, because this is not exactly
a
Silmarillion.
That is 100% podcast. Not the last Silmarillion reference you're going to make. Let's be real.
But the Sons of Fëanor make an oath that only they get the Silmarils because their dad created them and it's their inheritance. And so throughout the Silmarillion, they maintain that oath. And an oath is one thing for hobbits to fulfill, but an oath for elves to fulfill, and this is what Galadriel is experiencing in the show, if you're holding to an oath above everything else and you're immortal, then that can lead to some bad, dark places. Because there's, like I was saying, there's this natural change, and the change of nature and the ways that life and the world change is a big part of Tolkien. And when an immortal makes an oath to maintain something, whether it's the Sons of Fëanor saying that only we get the Silmarils, only the Sons of Fëanor get the Silmarils, it's his property, not heroic treasures or whatever. And Galadriel saying that no matter what, you may not be at war, but I'm at war and I'm always at war. For an immortal to do that is almost like fighting back against the world and nature and its propensity to change. And so, you know, that's certainly what Gil-galad and Elrond kind of see in her and her quest. They see this as ultimately destructive and not helpful because it's not adaptable to conditions or whatever. So it'll be interesting to see because both of those shadings of oaths are present in Tolkien's work. It can be a good thing and it can also be a really bad thing. And so I think that's important to keep in mind with Galadriel's oath.
Right. It's not something to be taken lightly.
Exactly.
And, you know, speaking of oaths, we see another oath sworn this episode over in the Southlands. A very bad oath.
Halbrand's homeland that he has abandoned. Yes. What's
exactly
going on over there?
So we get to see Adar is rising to power. He is amassing his army. He has set his sights on specifically Bronwyn's village. And they are, you know, we know that they are searching for the sword hilt. Mm-hmm. And he is coming. And he sort of makes an offer to some of the villagers that basically says, join me or die, essentially. We love a classic kind of warlord offer.
Yeah, pretty simple.
Pretty simple. And we see a couple of people decide to go with him and pledge their fealty to them. One of whom is Waldreg, who, man, this guy sucks. He just sucks. I do love his, have you seen him, lad? Have you heard about Sauron? And here we see he's like, oh my God, Sauron's back. And then Adar's like, no, I'm not. What are you talking about?
Right. Yeah, I loved Waldreg's kind of reveal last episode. That was one of my favorite moments of the show so far. And it's kind of interesting. You know, I wonder for him to directly kind of ask Adar if he's Sauron and be denied in that way. You know, we talked a lot last week about how we really enjoy how this show is playing very vague about Sauron's presence. And you kind of feel him in a lot of different places, but he hasn't manifested fully. And I wonder if Adar, you know, even though he wants to be his own person and isn't going to lie and say that he's Sauron, I wonder if he's been using that vagueness to his advantage, you know, whether it's among the orcs or whether it's among these Southlanders that he's trying to recruit. Kind of keeping it vague is probably good for him, but he can't take a direct question like that. Like in that case, he has to deny it because he wants to be known for himself. But, you know, that was interesting. I was interested kind of thinking about that and whether he's kind of likes to keep it vague among people or even have people think, he says he's not Sauron, but I don't know.
Well, it's a little bit how like Sauron is sort of like, yeah, I mean, I'm tight with Morgoth. Like I'm very much like carrying on his legacy. Like, you know, like, hey, if you really liked that guy, you should, you know what the next best thing is.
Right.
His second in command.
Right. Or even similar, like, you know, whenever there's a vacuum, like who's going to step up to fill that vacuum? And Sauron did that when Morgoth was gone. And now that Sauron's kind of in the wind, Adar's kind of doing that too. Like you said, a warlord kind of stepping up and, you know, well, who knows, but I'm here and you can follow me, you know.
I've been kind of impressed with how the show has kind of held Sauron back a little bit.
Me too. I didn't expect it.
Yeah, I didn't expect it either. I thought very much when they announced, okay, we're doing the Second Age story, I thought, okay, well, who are they going to cast as Sauron?
Who's hot Sauron, yeah.
Who's going to be hot Sauron? Oh, we have to get hot Sauron. I mean, like, come on. He's got to be, like, the hottest person ever. Like, I can't wait for the, like, thirsty Tumblr GIF sets about him. But seriously, like, that the rise and eventual fall of Sauron is the story of the Second Age, essentially.
Right.
And so I think the show is being very smart. It's sort of being like, he's lurking. His presence is being felt, and he might be a character we've already met. He may be an entirely new character.
Right.
Part of me does wonder if, you know, Celebrimbor and Gil-galad, or, you know, they've sort of got this idea planted in their heads of like, oh, we have to build this giant forge and maybe Mithril is the key to our stuff. Something kind of makes me wonder if like somebody's been whispering that in their ears.
Yeah. Did they come up with that idea themselves?
Somebody we haven't met yet. And so I think it's a very interesting idea for the show to present. What do you think? Do you think Sauron is someone we've met yet, or do you think it's someone we haven't met yet?
So of the likely candidates, which I would say are the most popular candidates online that I see people say are Sauron.
Clearly Malva the Harfoot. She's the worst. I'm kidding.
But even the Harfoots have some weird attitudes around, yeah. You know, Sauron's not a Harfoot, but, yeah. You know, that's what I like about it, is that you see this kind of darkness at the edges of a lot of different things. And I think it's important for this role that Sauron plays in the Second Age, like you said, particularly in Numenor, is he has to make people think that, like, oh, this guy isn't as bad as I heard. Like, right. I heard that this guy was a big old deal, but I can handle him. So I think this will be an effective way of doing that, is like, if you have all these rumors and tall tales and Galadriel's oath, and where's Sauron? Is he here? Is he not? And then he shows up in mortal form. It'll be easier for people to think like, oh, well, this isn't, he is like evil itself, you know? And when he's a person, it's like, oh, well, that's not,
he's just a dude,
incarnation of evil. I can strike a deal with him, you know, because that's what it is. It's not like people are like, well, I'll let him do whatever he wants. But the elves and the Numenorean kings will eventually convince themselves that they can handle him, that they can make a deal with him and keep him under control, which, of course, they are wrong about. But so I think this is an interesting stepping stone to getting there. I will say, of the main candidates, one of whom shows up for the first time in this episode, who we'll talk about in a minute. Obviously, Adar seemed like the most logical, which I think is why the show made a point of him denying it this episode. But I do have questions about Hallbrand.
I do too.
I do wonder if it's Hallbrand. Like, because one of the things I'm looking at, and I talk about it in my recap of this episode this week on EW.com, is what you're kind of seeing is you're seeing different figures and different characters step into roles or do things that we know Sauron does. Adar is a leader of orcs. Sauron and Morgoth are the only ones we've known to lead orcs. Hallbrand, it hasn't quite happened yet, but he is accumulating prestige and a reputation in Numenor. He's starting to get Pharazôn's ear. That's something Sauron does. Things like this are happening and they're split among different characters. So who's the most likely? I don't know. I think maybe my money is on it's someone we haven't seen yet. Of the ones we have seen, I don't know. I'm kind of looking askance at Hallbrand more and more.
Well, as soon as he sees a forge, he's like, that's what I want.
Exactly.
Do.
This is what I said about Sauron and Aule earlier, that he's a craftsman.
He's like, that's where I belong.
That monstrous strength has to come from somewhere. Yeah.
He's like, you know what you could use that forge to do? Make a really cool ring. Wouldn't that be awesome? So, yeah, I'm a little curious about that, too. I think it's a very interesting kind of thing that they're setting up. This is my other theory about Hallbrand. And this is, again, super early in a total theory and is a little, maybe a little, I don't think it's spoilery because it's just theory, but I wouldn't be surprised if maybe they were setting him up to be one of the Nazgul or a Wraith.
Sure.
So because like, you know, we know that the 9 ring wraiths were mortal men and they were mortal kings. And
maybe he's the Witch King. Oh,
I mean, wow. So that's my theory.
That would be awesome.
I have another theory. And see, I'm just going to throw out all my theories. We know there was the king under the mountain, the king of Dunharrow, who broke his oath and betrayed Isildur when it was time to fight Sauron.
Yeah.
And that was what was led to Aragorn calling for them to fulfill their oath. That, I mean, he could, we know he's walked away from his duties, yeah, in the past. So again, I'm throwing out like 9 different theories in the hopes that at least one of them will be correct. So I'm covering all my bases.
Yeah. And you know, the farther we get, you know, the especially the early episodes of the show just had to introduce us to so much. Now we've kind of got the ingredients in the pot and can kind of play with them and turn them over and think about them, which is fun. And I guess on that note, maybe we move from Sauron watch into Gandalf watch.
Let's go. It's time for Gandalf watch.
And talk about the first song in this show.
Let's go.
Which, as you alluded, quotes one of the most famous Tolkien poems. This is something that the movies have a little bit, you know, with Pippin's song in Return of the King, Treebeard's song, if you watch Two Towers Extended. But certainly in the books, people just burst into song all the time. Like,
there's so much singing.
There's so much music and lyrics in the text of Lord of the Rings, especially when characters are just like traversing nature. Because I assume this is something that J.R.R. Tolkien did in real life. We would go on these long walks through the woods and just kind of compose poetry about the trees he saw. And so we finally kind of get that in this episode with Nori has a song that she sings.
No, it's Poppy has a song.
Oh, it's Poppy. Okay. Sings.
Yeah, it's Megan Richards has a beautiful voice.
Yeah.
I think Megan told me or I read somewhere that originally, like, I think she was doing karaoke with the cast and the showrunners were kind of like, hey, would you be down to sing?
Oh, this is great scoop.
So which I absolutely love. And she was like, yeah, I guess. And I was totally delighted by this. I
so
love a musical montage. I have been so impressed by Bear McCreary's music throughout this entire series.
Yeah, you mentioned it earlier. I was hoping you would give him more of a shout out.
Yeah, I think to me, part of the reason the Peter Jackson films are so beloved is Howard Shore's score is incredible.
1,000%.
And the music is hugely elevates it. And I think Bear McCreary's score is doing the same thing for the show, where it is so extraordinary and beautiful, and it sounds Middle Earth-esque. You know, it feels kind of has that wonderful fantasy vibe to it. And I really loved Poppy's song here. It takes lines from, you know, that iconic Bilbo poem, Not All Who Wander Are Lost, All That Is Gold Does Not Glitter, et cetera, et cetera. And I kind of like the idea that maybe Bilbo composed that poem based on, it's about Aragorn. It's about right. Aragorn, you know, return.
The Riddle of Strider, I think it's called.
The Riddle of Strider. And, but I like the idea that he maybe lifted one of those lines from kind of like a classic Hobbit story or a classic Hobbit song.
I'm sure he did. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, because we know he loves songs. Oh my God. He all the time. And you hear Frodo and Sam, you know, reciting songs that Bilbo taught them. And so there's this idea of song as, you know, a way to connect with the generations that came before you and after you. And so I loved this whole bit. I was delighted by it. I mean, one of my biggest complaints about Tom Bombadil not being in the Peter Jackson
right.
films is that he's got some absolute bangers
of
songs.
He's got the best songs. His songs rock.
So good. So more songs, please.
Yeah.
Let's do a whole all musical episode. Like, give me a power ballad from Muriel. Like, I want to see.
I would love that, actually.
A beautiful duet between Durin and Elrond.
Yeah.
Like, just all music all the time.
Yeah.
Give me the musical episode.
They could do it. I mean, if they wanted to, I would buy it.
Tolkien would approve.
He sure would. That's what I'm getting at. This is a very Tolkien-y thing to have characters burst in the songs, especially traveling in nature, you know, and the Harfoots aren't traveling alone, thankfully, because they're stuck at the back of the line. They have some help from the stranger who is learning English, or common, as it's referred to in Middle Earth, but he's learning to speak. And so, you know, the time I think is drawing close when he will be able to speak for himself and tell us and the Harfoots a little bit maybe about who he is and what he's here for. Before I get into that, just a moment of Gandalf watch where we calculate all the Gandalf-esque things that the stranger does. When they're getting attacked by those monstrous warthogs and he kind of slams his fists into the ground, sending a shockwave to knock them back. You know, if he is Gandalf, one day he will have a staff that makes that a little easier, slam into the ground without breaking your poor hand. Wasn't sure about the ice, though. I don't know that that's a cataloged Gandalf power. He's usually associated with fire. But as we see, whoever he is, whatever powers he has, he's having some trouble keeping them under control and kind of learning to acclimate himself to being in Middle Earth, which if he is one of the Istari, he's one of the Maiar. That's another reason I brought that up, that has manifested in an earthly body. So it would make sense that there would maybe be a learning curve about, you know, things that you can do in Valinor cause a little more damage in Middle Earth.
Yeah, and he sort of inadvertently hurts Nori, which is a scene that kind of broke my heart a little bit. And you see for the first time, she's always been on his side. She has always trusted him. And for the first time, she truly sees how powerful he is and how he, even if he's not malicious, he can't always control his power.
Right.
And that was sort of a beautiful kind of heartbreaking moment between the two of them. And you know, the look in his eyes when he kind of realizes what he's done. It gave me a little bit of like, it gave me strong Iron Giant vibes.
Mm.
The whole, like, he doesn't know his own strength. He's sort of, and when she's like, no, you're a friend. And he's like, friend. And I was like, this is very Iron Giant to me.
Sure.
Yeah. Which is a movie I love very much.
Yeah. Another comparison that jumps to mind is Frozen, maybe just because of the ice, but, you know, Elsa kind of harming Anna when they're kids with her uncontrollable powers leads to repercussions throughout that movie. But I would say kind of the most interesting beat to me, that was all good stuff. I really liked the Harfoot segment this episode, and I like that we led off with it, which we don't always do to kind of recenter them after taking last week off. But something interesting, Nori and the Harfoots are no longer the only beings in Middle-earth that are aware of his presence. Obviously, everybody saw the comet land, and in this episode, we see a group of figures investigating the crater and running their hands along it. You know, Devin, as you and I have talked, and as if anyone who's been interested in Rings of Power and has kind of been following along the coverage and the hints of it in the months before the premiere may remember this, when the trailer dropped at San Diego Comic-Con, this character, this blonde Eminem-looking guy who's feeling around in the crater, was kind of tweeted out by a popular movie account as like, this is Sauron. And so, you know, it wasn't just because of that that I thought that we would see Sauron manifested in the show. You, as you said, you and I already thought that. But that was certainly had our expectations up to see, like, so-and-so will be playing Sauron. But on first glance, this guy is not giving me Sauron vibes. However, his name might also start with S, and he might be a slightly different figure. He and his little entourage are wearing white flowing robes, which Sauron is not particularly known for, even in his hot boy era. And one of them is holding a staff, which, as I said, the stranger does not have yet, and is not Saruman's staff, as we will come to learn it. But if the stranger is Gandalf, as the signs seem to be pointing, you know, we're obviously already playing a little loose with the lore, because Gandalf's arrival in Tolkien in Middle-earth is at the port of Cerdan, and that's where Cerdan gives him the ring. He, you know, crashing to Earth in a meteor is new. But one thing that would be a little harder to change, I think, is the order that the Istari arrive in Middle-earth. And in Tolkien, Gandalf is the last of the Istari to arrive. And so if the stranger is Gandalf, and they might just be, there might be a zigzag or a twist left, even in the face of the accumulating evidence, then Saruman would be here already. And while Gandalf, or Mithrandir, has always presented himself very humbly in Middle-earth, which is why Cerdan kind of, what Cerdan saw in him, that he was this great power but was not presenting it, Saruman's not really like that. And he...
Oh, he loves a show.
He loves a show. He loves fashion. He loves having followers. You know, this is a very brief snippet of a scene that we get. So maybe I'm reading a little too into it, but that's my read on it, is I would finger this guy for Saruman before Sauron.
An interesting theory, one I had picked up on, but now you might have convinced me. Because yeah, in the credits, these three are credited as, I think, the nomad, the ascetic, and the dweller, which doesn't tell us a lot. But
yeah,
there's three of them.
Yeah,
we know there are the five Istari, and they've got, at one point they're looking down at the crater, and they've got this sort of big plate, and it's got the stranger's constellation on it. That sort of like F-shaped constellation that we see him scratching into the and arranging with the fireflies. So they have some sort of connection to him, and it seems like they are searching for him in some way, shape, or form. But what they want with him is very intriguing, and this is another mystery that is very unsolved.
Yeah, and we don't know where it's going. Even if it is Saruman, I don't necessarily know what he's doing or what he's going to think of the stranger when he finds him. It would be fun if the other two were the Blue Wizards, but Devin and I are always hoping that
we're always on Blue Wizard Watch.
You know, their artifacts are, you know, a little aquamarine in addition to their white clothes. So yeah, an episode with a lot of kind of tantalizing teases and such. Devin, is there anything that you wanted to discuss that we hadn't gotten to yet?
I think we hit pretty much all the basics, just that I'm really curious to see where things go next. We only have three episodes left, 6, 7, and 8. And I'm curious whether we'll get to see some meetings between people as like the Numenoreans head to Southlands.
I really hope so. Yeah.
And we'll get to see some of these storylines get to converge a little bit, because up until now, a lot of people have sort of been in their own little kingdoms or literally on their own island. So I'm curious to see as people come together and whether we might get some meetings, because the name of this episode is Partings. So I'm curious whether the next one might be meetings.
Could be. Yeah, no, I totally feel the same. And that's kind of been the trust that I've put in the show since the beginning, is the show is very slow paced. I've heard from some people that they have a little bit of trouble getting through the first episode, which I think is why they released the first two at once, because the second is where you get some meetings and you get characters colliding and stuff, whereas the first one is a lot of table setting. And it's a show that knows its worth, you know, it knows the resources it has at its disposal. It's not at all worried about being getting canceled or anything like that. And I recognized that. And so my hope has been that, hey, it's a slow build, it's a slow burn, but given the production value, given the investment of the actors and the directors and the writers and all this stuff, the beauty and the construction of Numenor and all these other locales, that it will pay off and that things will start to escalate and collide. And, you know, the Numenorean expedition is kind of, I think, the first kind of flashpoint. You know, based on timing, it seems like they might arrive maybe right as Adar is trying to conquer Bronwyn's village. And so Galadriel and Arendir, that's a meeting that I would love to see. They maybe have a little more in common than they would with the high elven lords in Lindon. Bronwyn and Halbrand, that could be an interesting meeting. So that's the one that I think is first on the menu, but it wouldn't be surprising if the Harfoots run into people eventually, if these mysterious figures catch up with them and the Stranger. That's what I'm really looking forward to the back half of the season is, you know, there are things being built that are going to take seasons to pay off, like we said, whether it's the ultimate fate of Numenor, the ultimate fate of Khazad Dûm, the Last Alliance, those things are long game. But even in this first season, I think we're going to start seeing some fireworks go off. And I'm really excited for that.
I think the first few episodes have introduced a lot of questions. And I think we're starting to get a couple answers, yeah, which I'm very curious about and very excited to see. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we are headed to Lindon, and you can hear my interview with Benjamin Walker, a.k.a. the King of the Elves, Gil-galad himself. Stay tuned. Thank you so much for joining me, Ben. I'm so excited to speak with you again about episode 5.
My pleasure. It's pretty good.
It's a pretty fun one, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, I have a million questions for you, but we have to start with that amazing dinner table scene with Durin and Elrond and the table. Tell me, what do you remember most about filming that sequence?
It was kind of like this beautiful, fantastical poker game where everybody's trying to guess what cards the other one is holding without upsetting everyone at the table. And working with Owain is an absolute dream. You know, he's got these layers of prosthetics and beard and nose, and we're doing the scale work. So he's much smaller and he's there with the big glass. And when you stare into his eyes, all that stuff fades away and you're just talking to the prince. And with all that comes with making Middle Earth, where you can find those just pure quintessential moments of two craftspeople, that's just, mwah, it's gold.
Yeah, that's probably so much fun because you've probably got so many things to think about. You've got your costume, you've got, like you said, the scale work, you know, you're on these amazing sets. But like when you have those moments where you're like, oh, I'm having dinner with a dwarf and a bunch of elves, like that must be pretty magical.
Yeah, you're sitting there thinking, say Mithril, say Mithril, say Mithril. You know, like it, you do kind of, and you're supported by those other things, you know, that there are tools that create Middle Earth around you. And, you know, you may be thinking my ears itch and then all of a sudden you're just transported somewhere else. That happens rarely in any job. And that was one of the days where it happened tenfold.
That's pretty magical. And yeah, in this episode, we learn a little bit more about Gil-galad's motivations. You know, we learn that he's searching for Mithril. He and Celebrimbor, you know, believe that it will help stave off decay and preserve the power of the elves. What interested you about that sort of, you know, storyline that Gil-galad has this, you know, he's trying to do the right thing for his people, but he's sort of manipulating maybe some of the people around him?
Well, sure. Manipulating, and from my point of view, I'm sure Rob would disagree, is a bit of a strong word.
Fair enough.
That it's kind of the understanding that if there is no other way, that were I to flat out ask you, none of this would work. It's the idea that there's an asteroid coming towards the Earth. Do I tell everyone that, or do I call a guy who's got a spaceship and ask if I can borrow it? That's what a good leader does, is he accepts the burden of the responsibility and only divvies it out when necessary. Now, some people can be frustrated by that, of course, because you are controlling the flow of information. But that's what a loving parent does. Ask me when you're older. You don't tell your five-year-old, well, there's an asteroid coming towards the Earth. Well, give me a second and I'll explain what an asteroid is.
Exactly. When you're thousands of years old as an elf, and you've got all the cards, you have to be careful about what information you dispense.
Sure, especially when it involves the end of the Earth, end of the middle Earth.
There you go. Absolutely. And yeah, I think this whole episode is kind of a fascinating view into, kind of who Gil-galad is and what his motivations are. I mean, take me back to when you were first sitting down and kind of trying to figure out how to figure him out. What were some of like the pillars or guideposts that you found particularly helpful in kind of figuring out who he is and what his motivations are?
Sure. For example, he's one of the few that is unbeguiled by Annatar. He writes this letter to the Numenoreans, I think it's Tar-Menendor, I believe that's right, where he predicts the coming of evil. He has this kind of prescient nature, and that's interesting to me. I also find it interesting that there's a bit of mystery about his parentage. And if you look at the two family lines, one is kind of the warrior prince and the other is kind of the politician. And the fact that even later in his life, Tolkien was wrestling with who he wanted Gil-galad to be. I think that's indicative. I don't find that frustrating. I find that as another little clue that he exists in the space between the two. And also considering how far we have to go in his journey, a little bit of mystery goes a long way. That he is playing the long chess of peace. Even the fact that, what we know about Aglaos, in some ways he has this, nuclear weapon that he keeps under his bed. He's that he chooses not to use, the idea that he would flip the table is very believable. But when does he choose to use mercy? When does he use patience and grace? And that's a healthy thing.
I love that. And I love that, were you somebody who really like dove into the lore and wanted to like, it sounds like you really, kind of embraced everything that had been written about him, but also sort of tried to fill in some of the gaps and, with the show. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. And you have to. And even if it's not specifically about your character, you're learning about something your character would know. I mean, we're elves. We have eternal memories. Everything in the first stage, pretty much, he would understand. What would it have been like to have been a child refugee, in a sense, kind of waiting out war? How much death and destruction would he have witnessed in his coming of age? And all those little nuggets are important. And also, it's just fun to read. Some of the Silmarillion is dense, but I found this graphic novel on a fan site where they'd done a graphic novel, and I used it as Cliff Notes, and it really helped. If you're listening, thank you. Even trying to understand the poetry of how he writes, that's how the elves speak and think. It's only good to go back to the material, and I enjoy doing it. I found a job where part of it is they pay you to read Tolkien. I've pretty much won the lottery.
That's kind of the dream. Yeah. If I knew that was a job when I was a kid, I feel like that would have been my dream job. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Well,
exactly. Well, I want to be king of the elves.
Yeah. I like that there's freedom within the structure. We understand Tolkien's structure, and within that, we use what we know. And then, like in a scene with Owain, then you can play. He creates the playground. Your director tells you stay on the slide, and then you go have a good time.
Yeah. And I love, you know, throughout the series, I've really loved some of the scenes with you and Rob as Elrond. I think he's so extraordinary, and I love the relationship there. Tell me a little bit about working with Rob. What's he like on set?
Awesome. He wears the half-elf nature of Elrond very well. That kind of troubled, needing to prove himself. And it makes sense why he would feel manipulated. But I also think Gil-galad, knowing what he knows and kind of having the bird's eye view, can see that it's an opportunity for him to prove himself. We work well together. We went to the same college, so we have a similar vocabulary. And we both love Tolkien. And we both feel a level of responsibility to the material. So it's great. He also has an incredible sense of humor. Don't talk to Rob for too long, or he will do an impression of you that will shatter your self-image.
Does he have impressions of you and everybody?
Everyone. And they're chillingly accurate.
Which was the most chilling?
He does a verbatim impression of the message on my voicemail. So, and like the realization that that's been on there for years and people have been hearing it, and this is a pretty good recreation of how it sounds, makes you just very self-conscious.
That's amazing.
And also laugh. You know, we laugh a lot. Yeah, Rob's great. He's a good man.
I love that.
He's a really good actor.
Absolutely. And, you know, last time we spoke, you know, the show was about to premiere. You were just starting to screen the first two episodes for people. And now here we are, more than halfway through the first season. What have the past few weeks kind of been like for you? What's it been like to, you know, you made this, you spent years of your life making this thing, and now it's out in the world and you get to share it with people.
Well, luckily, we really haven't had any downtime before prepping for the second season. And I don't mind the press of it. A lot of actors get a little snooty about it. But yeah, it can be grueling. Travel can be hard. Being away from home is hard. But I'm proud of it. I'm excited to share it. And I'm doubly excited to get to work on the second step of the journey.
That makes sense. And yeah, I mean, getting to watch the show each week and see finished scenes, or getting to see what your colleagues were doing in the Southlands or in Numenor. What's been the most delightful surprise as you've gotten to, you know, experience this show?
It sounds like a negative thing, but what's been really surprising is how great everybody is. Not that I didn't think they would be, but that in the seeing of the other worlds that they've created, because you have an idea and you know them and you've seen some of their work and you visited on set, but then when it all comes together, you feel this immense sense of pride for your friends. You go, man, Lloyd, you look gorgeous in a wig. And you see them shine at what they do well. And that's great. And because you're in it, you don't ever really get a truly objective viewing experience. So to see that has been the great joy. Like I was saying about Owain, you know, I got to see it on the day, but we were sitting across the table when they push in on him and get super close when he's talking about how the stone from the table is used in tombs. And like, it's just the colors are so beautiful. It's good to see good people do well.
Yeah, I imagine, especially after, you know, you guys were in New Zealand for, you know, months and years, and to finally get to see the finished product must be pretty magical.
And you come away with, I come away with after seeing it, that was worth it. Like, I like particularly some of the Harfoots, you know, that I know how cold they were and how dirty they were. And there was a day when Owain and Sophia were filming in their dining room, and there were all these fires, so they had like black soot around their noses. And at the end of it, I just go, it was totally worth it. Everything that was uncomfortable or frustrating or difficult was worth it.
Absolutely. All right, great. Well, I will let you go, but thank you again so much for taking the time to speak with me. And I cannot wait to see the rest of the season. We've only got a few left.
I know. And we're going to get you a second one here soon.
Can't wait. All right, great.
Well, it was my pleasure. Anytime.
Our thanks to Benjamin Walker, and our thanks to you for joining us. If you like listening to us chat about Middle Earth, you can follow the podcast and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can find us on social media. I'm at Devin Kogan and at CM Hollop. Come find us and tell us all your theories about Sauron and Gandalf and Mithril and Halbrand and stone tables. Thank you so much for joining us. And that's it for this episode of All Rings Considered. If you liked what you heard, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. To keep the conversation going, follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials, at EW on Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag us at Devin Kogan and at CM Hollop.
This episode of All Rings Considered is hosted by Devin Kogan and Christian Hollop. Produced by Devin Kogan, Christian Hollop, Chanel Johnson, Sammy Junio, Lauren Klein, and Dalton Ross. Edited by Lauren Klein. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.